Okay, let's start. Yeah, just to give you some advance warning, so in 2 weeks I will be in Oberwalfach, so there will be no class that week. And today I have to leave earlier at about 11:30 or so to catch a train to go to Scarborough, where I have a meeting at 1. So there were a few questions. Some I got by email, and I also got some hints on how to correct my mistakes from last time. And there was another question back there. So what was your question? Boy. No, I mean, it is certainly clear that to understand the theory of motives, one needs to understand better the representation theory of the absolute Galois group, because it will act on the category of motives. And the desingularization, I was saying that, as you know, Hironaka's famous theorem says that in characteristic zero, or an algebraically closed field, you can resolve singularities. However, we do not know whether this is true in positive characteristic. It's known for surfaces, but it's already not known for threefolds. Not to mention whether you can resolve singularities in the mixed characteristic case. What I was trying to say is that it seems now that if one sort of backs away from the geometry and just looks what desingularization means on the level of the category of sheaves, then there is a theory of non-commutative desingularization which works in those cases where it is known how to do it, works like a charm. It's much easier than what you do in classical geometry. Yeah. Well, the point is that you see, when you stick within the category of schemes, you're basically stuck in the category of commutative rings and sort of their global versions, which are the schemes, right? However, if you allow yourself to pass to non-commutative objects, then you have a lot more wiggle room. Now, of course, it is a question of what you mean by a non-commutative desingularization, obviously. But sort of roughly speaking, what is a desingularization? So you have some space with some structure, algebraic structure, which might be singular. And so then you look for some manifold and some proper map, which is an isomorphism outside the singular locus. So if you look at the regular locus or smooth locus, and you take, so let's call this pi, you take pi inverse of x reg, then you want that pi induces an isomorphism here, right? Now, if you do, now you can do this on the level of categories, but now I'm going way, way ahead of what we're talking here. So if you look at the, say, the coherent sheaves, you look at the category, derived category of bounded complexes of coherent sheaves on X, and you do the same thing over here, then you have a push-forward map, right? You can take anything upstairs and sort of integrate over the fibers to get an object downstairs. You also have a morphism going back, which is basically just composition. If you think of a sheaf as being functions on x, then the corresponding functions on x tilde are just the compositions with pi. And so what you try to do now in general, if you don't have any idea of what geometrically the object x tilde should be, well, you still can try to find some triangulated category which replaces this, which comes equipped with a pair of functors, let's call them P lower star and P upper star, which encapture, for example, the fact that x tilde is smooth is the same thing as to say that the so-called global dimension of this category is finite. Now, you need also to encapture, for example, the fact that pi is proper and that this is basically an isomorphism outside the singularities. So how you encode this in terms of these two functors, this is way too technical. I'm not going to go there here. Now, what happens sometimes, for example, sort of the most famous example is the following. You take G is a finite subgroup in SL2C. Finite subgroup. These are all classified, very classical objects. Basically, to each platonic solid or to each regular polyhedron, there belongs one such finite subgroup. I'm not going to go there. So what you can do is you see this group G acts on the complex plane. Because it's, what does this say? This says G is realized as a group of 2 by 2 matrices with complex entries, which are invertible and have determinant 1. So, for e.g., the simplest example is you take plus minus the identity. Take this as your group G, just a cyclic group of order 2. Now, how does it act on the complex plane? Well, obviously, it sends the point Z to minus Z, the non-trivial element. So then you look at, so G acts on C2, and so you can take the orbit space. Take the quotient by the group action. You identify points that are conjugate under the action of the group. So what you get if you do this here, so you take the complex plane and you identify each point with its opposite, then what you get is a quadratic cone. So it has a singularity, a very mild singularity at the origin. Now, how does the, so this, in this case, so for this group here, which is just a multiplicatively written group of order 2, so here we have C2 modulo mu2, which is just a quadratic cone. What is the desingularization of this? Well, the real picture is simply a hyperboloid. And what happens under this map is that sort of one equator gets pinched down to a point. That's what this map does. So this here is x tilde, the real picture. Yeah? And so what you see is this is what you get from blowing up the singularity. This singular point here gets replaced by a circle. In the complex picture, it gets replaced by a sphere. Now, so this is sort of the simplest possible singularity and the simplest possible desingularization. However, part of what's nowadays called the Mackay correspondence says that as well, instead of, so if you look at this category, which sort of captures the geometry and what's going on x tilde, that you can as well realize it in a non-commutative way by taking the ring. Instead of taking some relatively complicated space, you take a ring, namely, or you take the polynomial ring and two variables, which is sort of the polynomial functions on C2, and then you take what's called the twisted group algebra with mu2. So this ring here, let's call it A, So how does this ring look like? Well, it consists of the set of all pairs, or P plus Q times sigma, where P and Q are polynomials into variables, and sigma is sort of the non-trivial element in mu2. So you add them component-wise, and you multiply them by saying that P plus Q sigma times P prime plus Q prime sigma is going to be, you see, well, first of all, you have P times P prime. There's nothing happening here. You also get P times Q prime times sigma. And so the things where one needs to be careful is if you have to move sigma over a polynomial. So what happens there is, you see, sigma is an element in mu2, so it acts on these polynomials. Precisely what it does is it just sends u and v to minus u and minus v. So what happens here is, for example, the sigma moves over p prime by applying it to p prime and then pulling it out. And similarly here, you pull sigma over q prime, and then sigma squared is the identity, so it's just 1. So the multiplication in this ring is given in this way. In particular, it's not commutative, right? Because p times sigma and sigma times p are not the same thing, right? Because sigma times p is sigma applied to p times sigma, which is different in general from p times sigma. No. It's not much easier. It's just the category of modules, finitely generated modules, left modules, say, over this ring. So it's purely algebra. And so this isomorphism here is what's called the Mackay correspondence. In the two-dimensional case. Now, you can do this with any finite subgroups of SL2. So if you want to go back to the general picture, all you do is you replace this by the finite group G. So what has happened is, you see this thing here, there is no space that's canonically attached to it. However, from the algebraic point of view, it's something quite simple. And this is sort of the tip of the iceberg of what one means by non-commutative desingularization. You look for some kind of algebra or sheaves of algebras which is no longer commutative, but that the category of modules or sheaves over that gives you the appropriate substitute of the desingularization. Yeah? No, stacks are sort of a substitute for orbit spaces, right? Because if you have, in almost all moduli problems, you have some group of automorphisms acting. But these groups are usually bad. They do not have very nice properties. If you were to look at the orbit space under this action, you would lose all good geometric properties. For example, would no longer be Hausdorff, the topology would be totally messed up. So what you do instead is you sort of work with the orbits directly and the group action instead of dividing it out. That's when you get a stack. Feel free to do so, but it's not necessary. And in general, so this is just a particular example, and the groups come in because they are used to define the singularity. In general, there will be no group here. What will happen, even though it's very difficult, or at this point, if you have never seen this before, it's impossible to connect the two things. But what you try to do is, if you have your singular space, you want to try to find some signature sheaf on it. Think of it as a vector bundle which sort of has some particular structure over the singular points. Right? So if you take the singularities away, then you have a manifold. And so assume you take a vector bundle on this manifold. And now you have to fill in what should happen over the singularities. Now what happens in the cases where we know that commutative desingularization works is that there is some object which is behaves like a vector bundle, but it's not. And it's a vector bundle which is essentially cohomology free. But again, I'm not going to explain that either. And then what happens is that the sheaf of algebras which gives the desingularization is simply the endomorphism algebra of this vector bundle over X. So this is sort of the holy grail, if we could do this in all cases. Find some vector bundle which sort of encapsulates all the information about the singularities, then take its endomorphism ring, and the derived category over this endomorphism ring should be the substitute for the desingularization. And that's actually what happens here. Of course, I would have to tell you what's the module such that this is the endomorphism ring. Well, it's actually not so bad. You see, X corresponds, as I said, it's C2 mod G, but algebraically, that's the same thing as to say you look at this space called spec underlying the ring of invariants. So you take the polynomial ring in two variables, you take the polynomials that are invariant under the group action. For example, if you take the mu 2 action, which sends u and v to their opposites, then the ring of invariants is just the ring of even polynomials. Right? If you take an even polynomial and you switch the signs, nothing happens. And so the M here is just going to be the polynomial ring itself viewed as a module over the ring of invariants. So as C U V G module. And then it's a very nice result by Maurice Auslander, which proves that if you look at the endomorphism ring over the invariant ring of the polynomial ring, then what you get is precisely this twisted group algebra, CUV star G. Yeah? This one, the non-commutative desingularization? Well, I mean, sort of what I described here, that has a very, very long history. So for these so-called Kleinian singularities, that is the quotient of the complex plane by a finite subgroup of SL2, that goes back to Felix Klein. Right? He wrote this marvelous book about the icosahedron and the equation of fifth degree, where he tried geometrically to study how to solve equations of degree 5, which, as you all know, in general, can no longer be solved by radicals. Right? But they can be solved by elliptic functions. And so he dedicated the whole book to this one question, and the first half of the book, he just studies the finite subgroups of SL2C, the reason being that sort of what is the Galois group of the general equation of degree 5? Well, it's of course S5, but if you adjoin a square root of the discriminant, which is simply a quadratic extension, it drops down to A5. But A5 is a symmetry group of rotations of the icosahedron. And there is a sort of a double cover of that group, sort of the binary icosahedral group in SL2C, which is the most complicated of the finite subgroups of SL2C. And he solved the equation of fifth degree by studying the geometry of this quotient space. Anyway, so this is Felix Klein. Start there, if you like. But of course, he did not talk about desingularization of anything. But the generalization, sort of the two-dimensional picture I described here, well, there are two things. The one paper where it is really made explicit is by Kapranov and Vassarow a few years back, I think in 99. And then the three-dimensional generalization, that's what I mentioned last time, is by Tom Bridgeland, Alistair King, and Miles Reed. And that's appeared in 02 in the Journal of the AMS. And the generalization for non-commutative desingularization in general, there's a various paper by Michel van den Berg, and also, for example, Kawamata gave a non-commutative interpretation of flops. So he described what is the algebraic version, non-commutative version of a flop. If you don't know what a flop is, never mind. Okay? But as I say, this is very much at the initial stages. There's sort of a dream out there. Whether we ever get there is by no means clear. But when it works, it is very easy. That's sort of the interesting part. And in the algebraic desingularization, the characteristic never appears. That's the other intriguing thing. Right? People have wondered for a long, long time, why can't you generalize Hironaka's theorem to characteristic P? Why doesn't it work? Nobody really understands why not. I mean, there are various sort of things where one knows that Hironaka's proof cannot go through in characteristic P, but still, that doesn't really mean that one couldn't find a way around it somehow, just replacing the argument. Anyway, so this is way, way beyond what I wanted to talk about, and I don't think even it answered your question, but at least I tried. Any more questions? No? Okay. So somebody sent me an email. Maybe you could identify yourself. Graham? Not even here, huh? Wanted to know, asked some questions about the opposite category and had some difficulties what I said about and I want to maybe it's just going to confuse you, but you see, we said if we have a category C, then we can associate to it its opposite category. And that category has the same objects, the same morphisms, except that the morphisms are read backwards. Right? So there's really nothing mysterious here. It's just sort of like replacing reading from left to right by reading from right to left. Just turn everything around. However, so if you take a monoid, so just a set with an associative multiplication and a unit, then you can, of course, as well define the opposite monoid, where you simply say, so if you here you have a multiplication, m times m prime, and in here, well, let me stick to what I did the other day, just to distinguish the elements here and here, even though it's the same set, I'll just adorn them with this symbol up. And so how do you define the opposite multiplication? Well, by multiplying them in the wrong order. And so this is the opposite monoid. And this is compatible with this definition up there in the sense that if you take the classifying category of the monoid, remember this is just a category with one object and having as its endomorphisms just a given monoid, if you take the opposite here, well, then it's easy to see that's the same thing as taking first the opposite monoid and then its classifying category. And so, you can, of course, do the same thing if, say, R plus times is a ring. In particular, then you say that the classifying category of the ring is simply the classifying category of the multiplicative monoid. The addition does not enter. And so, if you go to the opposite category, well, what does it mean? Well, as I said, the addition you don't even see. You just replace the multiplication by the opposite multiplication. Well, but that's what's called the opposite ring. If you have any ring that can multiply, then you can sort of read it everything backwards, and that's what you call the opposite ring. So the addition does not enter. The addition stays the same. Why does this concept never occur in groups? Because you say, well, what is he talking about? Why don't you see in first year algebra the notion of the opposite group? Because for a group, the opposite is isomorphic to the group itself. Namely, you just take the map which sends X to X inverse. Okay. And it is a useful concept, as we'll see later, to be able to talk about the opposite group, even though it's the same thing as the original. You see, this morphism does revert the multiplication, right? As we all know. Now, of course, one has to distinguish, what does it mean that G up is equal to G? Yeah. Or in general, if you have a monoid, which is equal to itself, which simply means that the identity is an isomorphism. This is the same thing as G, respectively, M being commutative. Right? For example, there are many non-commutative rings which are isomorphic to their opposite algebras, opposite rings. So here, exercise. Show that if you take the tensor algebra, so let's say V is a finite dimensional, no, actually, let me be even more specific. Take the tensor algebra over X1 up to Xn with some coefficients. Choose your favorite coefficients, let's say integer coefficients. So these are the words with integral coefficients in the Xi's. You're not allowed to switch them around. And the multiplication is simply concatenation of words and pulling out the constants and multiplying them in the usual way. Right? So an element in here, so this is a set of all linear combinations of AI, XI, finite sum, sort of where I is just a string, I1, I2, IN, well, I knew finite, so finite strings, and the AI is in Z. You multiply by simply concatenating and multiplying the coefficients, and you add component wise. Exercise, prove. This ring is highly non-commutative, right? Because x1 times x2 is never the same as x2 times x1 in this ring, in two variables. In one variable, it is commutative, but not as n is greater or equal to 2. However, it is isomorphic to its opposite. Right? What's the isomorphism? Or the, well, I call it the palindrome, right? You just read every word backwards. So to a word, XI1 up to XINU, you assign the word, but you just read the other way around. Okay, so to make things even more complicated, this is sort of a mistake one can easily make. It's at the beginning. Namely, if you have R a ring, then we can attach to it, say, the category of right R modules. I prefer right modules because then the coefficients are on the opposite side from the morphisms, because I still want to write the morphisms to act from the left. So the objects are obviously all the modules, the right modules, and the morphisms are just the R-linear maps. Now, if you take the opposite ring, and you take the right modules over the opposite ring, what is that? Well, that's the same thing as the category of left modules. Yes? Maybe you come across this probably in the connection with vector spaces, if you ever saw them over skew fields. So you have left and right vector spaces, and you can move from one to the other by simply changing the multiplication in the underlying skew field. However, and that's sort of the big no-no, neither of these is the opposite of the module category. So be careful where you put your ops, right? So here it should be really like this. As we will see later, this category here, the opposite of the module category, has some properties that you never see in linear algebra. It cannot be. This one cannot even be isomorphic to any module category. Never, ever. It is abelian. No. There's an embedding theorem. But I'm saying it's not the same as a module category over any ring. So, be careful where you place your opposites. All right. So I apologize again for the mistake I made last time about claiming that for groups, epimorphisms and surjections were not the same thing. Adam Gregson pointed out this is an exercise in MacLane's book on categories for the working mathematician. So here's the correction from last time. So in the category of groups, a morphism is an epimorphism if and only if it is surjective. But it's not entirely obvious. But the idea, the counterexample that was given last time by somebody here, is almost the general solution, right? Remember when I claimed that, well, I'm not even repeating a false claim. But so I also pointed out to you that it is no longer true in a general category that an isomorphism is the same thing as an epimorphism plus a monomorphism. So there are categories where you have morphisms that are epimorphisms and monomorphisms, but not isomorphisms. In particular, in those categories, you will not have image factorizations. Right? What you would like to have is, if you have a morphism, describe its image and factor it. So if you have any decent algebraic theory, if you have some morphism from X to Y, F, then you can factor it as an epimorphism followed by an injection, by a monomorphism, and then you call Z the image. And such a factorization is normally unique. However, in a general category, that does not need to be true. So let me spend a few moments to discuss this, and I'll take this straight out of some lectures by Maurice Auslander. It's called so-called Queen Mary lecture notes, because that's where he gave them in 1970. They were only published posthumously. They are included in his collected works, and that's the only source where you can find it. Now, first, before delving into this more, let's make a few remarks that hold in general. So if you have, so first of all, recall, what does it mean that F is an epimorphism? So F is some map F from a morphism from X to Y. Well, remember, to be an epimorphism is the same thing by definition as to say that whatever you plug in the second argument, if you look sort of in the category C, so in C, so this is a map of sets from HOM Y, Z to HOM X, Z, that this is an injective, is injective. Or written out explicitly, what it means is that epimorphisms are right cancelable. So it's the same thing as to say that GF equals HF implies G equals H. Because this here is sort of, if you have G and H, of course, for this to make sense, G and H have to have Y as the source and some common target, call it Z, and so then you would have G and H in here. They map to GF and HF respectively, and to say that the map is injective means if GF equals HF, then G equals H. Now, from the definition, we see immediately the following. So if G and H are epi, so is the composition. Follows immediately from the definition, right? Conversely, if GH is an epi, then what do you get? The composition, think surjectivity. If the composition is surjective, you know that the last one must be surjective. So then G is an epi. That's still true, and just check it immediately from the definition. If G has what's called a section, i.e., there exists some H such that GH equals the identity, then G is an epi. Right? That follows from the previous one, because any identity morphism is an epimorphism. So if you have GH is the identity on some object, then certainly G is an epimorphism. And this kind, which admit the section, so one calls G is a split epimorphism. for example, in the category of sets, every epi is split. And so is any mono. So I'm just writing down the notions for epimorphism, leaving it to you to dualize the whole thing for monomorphism. Except that, yeah, for monomorphisms, you could say monomorphism has a cosection if the corresponding equation holds, but it's usually called a retract. In K vector spaces, every epi or mono is split. It's slightly more complicated, but of course part of linear algebra. So take your favorite field, take the vector spaces over it, the linear maps as morphisms, then every epimorphism or monomorphism is split. However, in the category of groups, or in the category of abelian groups, not every epi is split. For example, take the projection from Z onto Z mod NZ. This is an epimorphism, but it is not split. Just think what it would mean if you had a map going this way, a homomorphism of groups. Well, the image of the class of one would be an element of order n, out of luck, right? All right. Now we have the following simple sort of diagram of implications. If you have that F is an isomorphism, remember this means that F has a two-sided inverse. That implies that F is a split mono, and also that F is a split epi. And of course, this just implies F is a monomorphism. And so the big question is, when is the conjunction of these two the same? Now, not quite, because it's slightly, at first glance, it looks a little bit weaker, right? Because this is saying that you have F times G equals the identity, right? That's saying it's a split epi, it has a section. And this is saying that there exists some H such that HF is the identity. So all we are requiring here is both the existence of a left inverse and a right inverse, but we do not necessarily require that they are the same. However, well, just multiply this by H or this by G, right? So you get HFG, and because it's associative, we see on the one side, if we put brackets like this, we get G. If you put brackets like that, we get H, and thus the left and the right inverse have to be the same. Thus, K drawer's question has a positive answer. So it is true that if we take the conjunction of these two, both, and actually it's enough to say that it's split on one side. So this is sort of second exercise. If F is a mono and a split epi, then F is an isomorph. And of course, same thing if you move the split from the epi to the mono, which is the dual statement. Proof is again very simple, same line as here. So, split ones are fine, but there are not enough split morphisms usually, like in the category of groups or abelian groups. So, what is a proper notion that allows us to say something about the image factorization? And so the notion that Maurice introduced in these lectures was notion of a strong epimorphism. Definition. So F from X to Y is a strong epimorphism if the following holds: if in every diagram, when we have F here, and so sometimes epis are indicated by putting a double hat on the arrow. I'll do this now just to make things more visible. And you have a monomorphism. So monomorphisms are usually given by either like this, or if you are a purist, you say, well, it should be the dual notion to this one, so you put two things at the end. Depends on your taste. And so you have U and V here, and you have any morphisms here. Well, look, what could you say if this were a diagram of maps of sets or groups? So I have an epimorphism here, and then some map, let's call it A, to something else, V. On the other hand, this composition can be factored like this, and I know that the second one of them is an inclusion. What would I know? Well, I would know that the image of Y must be contained in U. Yes? If you think of this as an inclusion, then this diagram says that the image of Y under A must be contained in U. So, we'll say that F is a strong epimorphism if in every diagram with K a monomorphism, there exists a morphism alpha from Y to U such that K alpha equals A. Okay? So first thing, consequent, it follows a few things. Namely, first of all, it follows that then also alpha F equals B. So the requirement is that this triangle here on this side, on the right side, commutes. It follows automatically that the one on the left side commutes. Why is that? Well, to say that this is true, it suffices to establish it after we apply K, because K is a monomorphism, so preserves inequality or equality. So we have K alpha F equal KB. Is this? So we have to establish that. But what's KB? Well, KB is AF. And F is an epimorphism. So So this, well, first of all, sort of K, so, okay. So clearly K alpha F equals AF, right? That's the assumption, but this implies that K, so this implies that alpha F equals B. So that's the first part. Second part is alpha is necessarily unique. Well, because K is a monomorphism, for example, so we have that if A were equal to K alpha and also equal to K alpha prime, well, this would imply that alpha equals alpha prime. Because K is a monomorphism. So if there is such a thing, then it is unique and it makes both triangles commute. Now, what's the notion of a strong monomorphism? Well, it's the same thing, except that you start by saying a monomorphism K is a strong monomorphism if for every epimorphism F you have the same factorization. So let's say K is a strong mono if and only if for every diagram with F epi alpha exists. And then again, it makes both sides commute, and it's unique. So, as usual in this business, let's write down a few properties. So, if G and H are strong epis, this implies that the composition is a strong epimorphism. Might amuse yourself to write down the corresponding diagrams. Conversely, if GH is a strong epimorphism, then G is a strong epimorphism. So it's the same property as for epimorphisms, any isomorphism is a strong epi and a strong mono. This implies that any split epi, well, let me write it like this. This implies split is stronger than strong. So any split epimorphism is particularly a strong epimorphism, and same for monos. So the next one is perhaps a sort of the crucial thing. If F from A to B is both epi and mono, then the following are equivalent. A F is an isomorphism. B, F is a strong epi. C, well, F is a strong monomorphism. So what goes wrong by saying that a morphism which is an epimorphism and monomorphism is an isomorphism is that at least one of the two factors has to be strong? So, thus, for a category to expect that it admits sort of image factorization as we know it, the extra property one needs is that epimorphisms or monomorphisms are strong. So, with this notion, well, unfortunately, it is sort of left open which of the two should be strong. And correspondingly, we get two different notions of an image. But they are dual to each other. So, and I need to convince myself which one is which. So this is not something you need to, will not be on the test. In other words, it's just to show you how one has to dig into what one, of course, obviously understands about fundamental properties of maps if one wants to transpose them in a correct way into the language of categories. So, here's a definition. C, any category. F from X to Y, any morphism. And then we define A, the coimage of F, is a factorization. Well, not the. Sorry. A coimage of F is a factorization X to Z to Y let's say K and G such that K, sorry, maybe I'll reserve the order, such that G is a strong epimorphism and K is a monomorphism. And so the image of F, or an image of F, so, and then you set Z to be the coimage of F, and an image of F is a factorization say F from X to U to Y what do you want here? G prime, K prime, where G prime is epi and K prime is a strong mono. And then one sets U to be the image of F. Now, of course, this definition already indicates that what next thing you prove is that these things are unique. And by the way, you will find in most books dealing with categories, you will find a definition of the coimage and the image, which is quite different from this one. It covers only a special case of this, special case in the context of abelian categories. In abelian categories, there's a different notion, a definition of a coimage and image, we'll get to it, which is precisely this notion in that context. But the advantage here is that you don't need to have any properties of the surrounding category to make pronouncements here. So, the first thing is, so let's see how these factorizations behave. So, that's true. Yes, of course. of course. For example, take the classifying category of the integers, which we discussed last time, so where the integers are thought of endomorphisms of one point. Then every integer except for zero is an epi and a mono, but only plus and minus one are isomorphisms. So there, lots of things must go wrong. Not to my knowledge. Would be an interesting question, for example, if you look at the category of rings or commutative rings. There, images and co-images exist, but they are not the same, usually. That's how they exist. So you were just asking where they exist. Whether one can complete it so that these notions exist. Good question. Well, assign it as an exercise.
Now suggest another question. Is there a natural notion of a quotient of a category so that it would be the same?
We'll come to quotients. We'll come there. And probably, okay, let me write down some properties and I'll comment on your question, okay? Because it's easier to do it with the diagrams on the blackboard. So again, let f from x to y be a morphism that admits a co-image. And assume we are given some other factorization and assume F equals, no, I have used, assume F equals AB is a factorization with A mono and B epi. So in other words, what we have is we have X. Here we have some factorization, let's say, through some object A, and here we have the co-image factorization. Then the claim is there exists a unique, so we'll say that B is an epi and A is a mono. Right, so it looks like an image factorization. And so I claim that there exists a unique alpha which makes this diagram commutative. Now, why is that? Because this here, by definition, is a strong epimorphism. And I was toying with the idea, because epimorphisms are usually denoted with two heads. Maybe one should use three heads to just indicate that it is a strong epimorphism. But then if you look at the definition, you have a strong epi here, you have a mono here, and collapse these equalities, then the definition of a strong epimorphism is precisely the existence of such an alpha. And we already saw there that it is unique. Moreover, if B is also a strong epi, then alpha is an isomorphism. I.e., the co-image of F is unique up to unique isomorphism. So how do you see that? So assume we have two such factorizations where the epimorphism in question is strong. So then I claim alpha is an isomorphism. Well, what did I call it there? So I call this one G and this one K. So how do you see that? Well, if B is a strong epi, this implies, because alpha factors B, this implies that alpha is a strong epi. Sorry. I forgot to make one mention before. Namely, there exists a unique alpha. So, I hope you left enough space to squeeze it in. So this unique alpha which exists here is always an epi and a mono. Alpha is an epi and a mono. For example, if you just look at the right square here, then you see that A times alpha equals K. But K is a monomorphism, and so alpha is a monomorphism as the left factor, as the right factor. Similarly, if you look at this diagram, B is an epimorphism, thus alpha, B equals alpha G, thus alpha is an epimorphism. So this holds always. But if B is in particular a strong epimorphism, then the same holds for alpha, but we already, I said it somewhere down there, this implies that alpha is an isomorphism. Because alpha is now a strong epi and a mono. So plus alpha mono implies alpha is an isomorphism. Okay? Now, there's of course the dual notion. So if you want, and this goes back to Dror's question, the factorization over the co-image that is using a strong epimorphism is sort of the tightest factorization with respect to the epimorphism side. Right? You can, any other such factorization you can get to from here. So this morphism is sort of closest to X, closer than any other epimorphism. And so that it strongly indicates that indeed you can always add one. Just throw in such an initial factorization. Well, I'll come to this later. I'll think about it, whether one can actually prove this or not. So now one has a dual notion, of course, of the image. So let's assume F admits co-image and image. In that case, of course, one has, then there exists a unique morphism alpha from the co-image of F to the image of F, and this morphism is unique up to, it's both mono and epi. Yeah, because you just replace A by the image, then you see this is just a special case. And so in particular, if you are in a category where isomorphisms are the same as monomorphisms, as morphisms that are both mono and epi, then it follows that alpha is an isomorphism and there is no need to distinguish between the co-image and the image. Right? So that's the remark. So if every morphism in C that is mono and epi is an iso, then co-image of a morphism F is the same as the image of F canonically. In other words, there is a unique isomorphism which does it. All right. So, here's a lemma. For morphism for F, the following are equivalent. A, F can be factored as AHG, where G is a strong epi, and H is a strong mono. B, the canonical F admits co-image and image. And both, and they are isomorphic. And the canonical morphism is an iso. Well, that's clear. Just a lot of new words, but there's nothing deep going on. And so now we come sort of closer to the definition, what we want. The morphism F has what's called analysis if A is satisfied, if F equals AHG with G a strong epi, H a strong mono. So here are the properties. And that is, if you know F as an analysis, you don't have to worry anymore. So if F has an analysis, then every factorization F equals H prime G prime with H prime mono G prime epi is an analysis. In other words, then automatically the two constituents are strong. And the reason is, again, just this diagram, because you can sandwich . So you have a unique alpha here, and you have a unique beta here, and you are told that the composition is an isomorphism, because that's what it means that F has an analysis. Right? So all these compositions from X to Y represent F. So you know that sort of the smallest with the smallest epimorphism and the one with the smallest monomorphism, they're actually the same. That's the definition of having an analysis. Then if you have any factorization as a mono and epi, it is automatically isomorphic to the one. Yeah? Sure. Like this? So when someone says, sometimes that a category where every morphism has an analysis is called balanced. So in a balanced category, isomorphisms are the same as simultaneous epis and monos. So C is balanced if every morphism has an analysis and this is not quite what I just said. But here's a proposition which says for a category C, the following are equivalent, and I'll give you 6A. C is balanced, as we just defined. So in other words, every morphism has an analysis. B, each morphism can be written uniquely up to unique isomorphism. As an epimorphism followed by a monomorphism, C, in this category, every epimorphism is strong, every monomorphism is strong, and each morphism can be factored into an epi followed by a mono. By D, every morphism has a co-image and all morphisms that are epi and mono are isos. And of course, E is just a dual of D. In other words, instead of asking for the existence of a co-image, you ask for the existence of the image. So E, same as D, this co-image replaced by image. And finally, F, every morphism has an image and a co-image, and they coincide, and they are isomorphic. And the canonical morphism between them is an isomorph. So, Which categories are balanced? Well, the category of sets, the category of groups, notwithstanding what I said last time, the category of abelian groups, category of k-vector spaces, or more generally, any category of modules over a ring, they're all balanced. But the category of rings, or commutative rings, is not balanced. And this is, I'll give this as an exercise. Look at the inclusion of Z into Q, which we already used as an example last time. I said this is an epi and a mono. One has, this morphism has both an image and a co-image, namely, this is the co-image factorization, so let's call it E, and the image factorization is this one. So the co-image is the source and the image is the target. More generally, so if you have R to S, the ring homomorphism, then the co-image is what you would normally think of, just make sure, yeah, what you normally would think of as being the image, so you take R modulo the kernel of F, this is the co-image factorization. However, the image is quite a bit more complicated, namely, where you define yes, that's what I'm saying right now. So, with T is the following gadget. So, T is a set of all is a set of all S in S such that S tensor 1 equals 1 tensor S in S tensor S over R. So if you don't know about tensor products, never mind. Come to this later. But if you have seen them in algebra course, then you see this is a subring of S, and there's a natural map from R to here because any element in R you can move over because you tensor over R. So you have indeed canonical maps from R to T to S, and the claim is this is the image factorization. So i.e., in the category of commutative rings, both every morphism has both image and co-image, But they are usually not isomorphic, but usually not isomorphic. Sort of this is as far, it shows that so the category of rings is as far from linear algebra in some sense as it possibly can be. The first isomorphism theorem doesn't hold. Yes, the reason why doesn't this work in non-commutative rings? Well, the reason is that the tensor product is not going to be a ring again. Yes, you need commutativity to say that S tensor S over R is again a ring with the multiplication. Right, so you have S tensor S prime times T tensor T prime. You simply define this to be ST tensor S prime T prime. Now, if you had sort of lurking a non-commutative ring here, then you couldn't move T and S prime across each other. You would run into trouble. I haven't thought about it, but I would think so, yes. So co-images should be no problem. Actually, I think that even the second part is true, except that you have to replace the tensor product by the co-product of the algebras. So here's a question, because I haven't checked the details, but I believe if you look in the category of rings, same holds. So same holds, except that one would have to replace S tensor S over R has to be replaced with the free product S with S over R. So it's like the tensor product, right? Instead of just having two factors, you allow arbitrary words, but if you have an element from R, you can count it either to the left or to the right. Yes? It's like the amalgam of two groups. And why this is has to be the right thing, we'll see, not in a minute, but in a short while. So I think this is okay, but if you want to check the details and tell me about it, I'll be happy to see it. Okay, how about 10-minute break, and then we'll talk about functors.